That brings us to the middle chapter of the unit. And this middle chapter focuses on just one of two processes that are both shown in this first slide. This first slide of this chapter really sets up not only this chapter, but the next. I'll explain what I mean. But the green box here represents an ecosystem, as it's labeled. And I've told you before, when we were talking about ecosystems, that there is a throughput of energy. In other words, for any given ecosystem, energy enters. It gets transferred and transformed once it's in the ecosystem. So it's turned into different kinds of energy, moved from one object to another. But it eventually leaves, energy leaves. Well, it comes in as sunlight, it leaves as heat. But there's a throughput. Energy goes through an ecosystem. It doesn't stay within it. On the other hand, materials, things made out of atoms, more or less get recycled within the ecosystem. It's not perfect, of course. There's some spillage of materials from one ecosystem to another. But it's not so such a throughput as it is for energy. Okay, now, these four white arrows between a chloroplast and a mitochondrion here are drawn between the two major processes that we're going to focus on for these next two chapters. One of them, listed on the top, is photosynthesis. That's the next chapter. So that's not what we're talking about here, but that's one of the two processes. The other process is unfortunately labeled as cellular respiration, but that's only part of the overall second process. The overall process, represented by these bottom arrows, should be called the complete oxidation of glucose. That's what we're focusing on in this chapter. Okay, so when I say the complete process, which I will probably several times during this chapter, I'm talking about the complete oxidation of glucose, which includes cellular respiration, but it also includes glycolysis before cellular respiration. All right, we'll get to that detail in a minute. But the reason these are shown together is that these two major processes, photosynthesis and complete oxidation of glucose, are reciprocal processes. That's illustrated by the arrows here. But what do I mean by reciprocal? I mean that one process undoes the other process, undoes what it did. All right? Now, neither of these, photosynthesis or complete oxidation of glucose, is a single reaction. Both photosynthesis and the complete oxidation of glucose are complicated sets of pathways. So it's many, many reactions. But you can summarize a pathway or even a set of pathways by just abbreviating it into what you start with, the initial reactants, and what you end up with, the final products. In other words, just don't show the details in between. And what I mean, another way of saying what I said before, that photosynthesis is reciprocal with complete oxidation of glucose and vice versa, is that if you summarize photosynthesis by just listing its inputs and outputs, it will be just the reverse of the summary for the complete oxidation of glucose. All right? Photosynthesis starts with CO2 and water. After a lot of processing, out come organic molecules in the form of sugars and oxygen. And so the most important sugar is glucose. That's among these organic molecules. All right. Well, the complete oxidation of glucose starts with what photosynthesis spits out. Glucose, the organic molecule, and oxygen are inputs into the complete oxidation of glucose. And after many steps, what comes out is CO2 and water. So each of these undoes what the other one does. By the way, this also really illustrates graphically the reciprocal relationship between consumers and producers, which I've just mentioned a little bit in this course. It's more of a 182 topic. But producers, ecologically speaking, are organisms that are able to do one very important thing. Now, not all producers are photosynthetic, but most of them are. Some of them are chemosynthetic. But whether it's photosynthesis or chemosynthesis, the same thing happens. The important thing ecologically that happens in photosynthesis is something that's called carbon fixation. Carbon fixation refers to starting with carbon in an inorganic source and incorporating the carbon from that inorganic source into organic compounds. Remember that organic doesn't simply mean carbon-containing. Pure carbon's not organic, and remember, neither is carbon dioxide. So CO2 can be used by a plant usefully. It can't by us or any other consumer. CO2 is worthless as a fuel. It doesn't have any value as a fuel. All organisms require organic compounds. Not just carbon, but carbon in organic form. Well, the producers of the world can make their own organic molecules out of inorganic carbon sources. All of the rest of the organisms in the world, collectively the consumers, have to have their carbon already in organic form. So anything we eat has to be organic already. We can't just take in CO2. We'll die. Okay? But that's why we, all of us consumers, rely on producers to make these organic molecules. Well, the producer isn't making organic molecules for themselves. A plant, for instance, as a producer, undergoes photosynthesis to produce organic molecules for itself. But then we animals can eat the plant, or we can eat an animal that eats the plant, and so on. Plants have both of these organelles, so they're able to undergo photosynthesis to produce organic molecules, some of which are used as fuels in the process we're looking at in this chapter. The complete oxidation of glucose can then allow the plant to use the glucose that it's already produced by photosynthesis to release energy that it can use to make ATP molecules. We have to eat something that's already organic. Okay, so that's why ATP is here, though. ATP, we're going to talk a lot more about, and so I'll just say more about it as we get to other slides. Now to two. Well, I need you to think back several weeks ago in the laboratory section of the course when we talked about redox reactions. Remember when I introduced them to you, I told you at the time that we'd be talking a hell of a lot more about redox in Unit 3. Well, we're in Unit 3 now. So hopefully you haven't forgotten the definition. Remember that it's a portmanteau for good reason, because reduction does not happen unless oxidation is also happening. It's short for reduction oxidation, but they go hand in hand always. What is reduction? The gain of an electron or more, which is just the opposite of oxidation. Oxidation is the loss of an electron. And that's why they go hand in hand. Electrons aren't destroyed or created in this process. Therefore, anything that gains an electron must have gotten that electron from something, which by definition loses the electron. Okay? So in any redox reaction, something is becoming reduced, something is becoming oxidized. Well, this is a familiar example. We've talked about this ionization reaction many times with sodium, metal, and chlorine gas. they will get together, transfer an electron from the metal cation that does not want the, or it will become a cation, the metal that doesn't want that electron transfers it to the non-metal that does want it, right, to form a positive sodium ion and a negative chloride ion. Obviously, hopefully it's obvious, that if you have an ionization reaction, that is by definition redox, right? Because that ionization is by definition transfer of electrons. Doesn't have to be an ionization, as we'll see, but this one clearly is. And notice that it's sodium that is becoming oxidized because it is losing its electron. And we would call sodium, therefore, since it's becoming oxidized, the reducing agent, because it is causing the other thing, chlorine, to become reduced. Chlorine becomes reduced because it's accepting the electron. And remember, that's why you can make sense of the word reduce, which means come down. Well, it's the gain of electron reduces the thing because you're adding a negative to it. All right, that's a pretty easy to understand one. Three is a generalized version here. So X and Y can be anything. The E minus simply means an electron. And at the moment, the electron's with X, it gets transferred to Y. Once again here, something becomes oxidized, the thing that loses the electron. Something receives the electron and becomes reduced. Okay, so that's just a reminder of the definitions. Now, in 4, we're looking at an example of a redox reaction that is not ionization. So even though redox does mean electrons get taken from something and put onto something, it's actually not an entire transfer. I'll explain more about that in a minute, but let's look at the specific example. Here we have a combustion reaction. And a combustion reaction is really what we're studying in this chapter, even though not just in one step. What we do with our fuels is oxidize them via combustion. Combustion is a redox reaction in which a fuel gets reacted with oxygen. That's what qualifies it as combustion. And that's why you're not going to have combustion if you don't have oxygen available. Right? You can't light a fire in space. But the thing other than the oxygen is the fuel. And there are different fuels, but this one is an organic fuel because it contains carbon. What is CH4? I'll stand in front of the word so you can't cheat. It is methane, natural gas, the simplest possible hydrocarbon. Right? There are many hydrocarbons. Any of them can be used as fuel, which is why gasoline is such a useful fuel. It's just a mixture of a bunch of hydrocarbons. But CH4 is methane. That's what natural gas is if you turn on a natural gas stove. It doesn't matter if it's methane or any other organic fuel. And not all organic fuels are hydrocarbons. Remember, hydrocarbons contain only carbon and hydrogen. Well, in a cell, we don't use methane as the main fuel. We use what? What's the primary fuel in cells? Glucose. Which is not a hydrocarbon, it's a carbohydrate. So it has carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen in it. As we'll see later, though, whether it's CH4 or a carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen-containing fuel, as long as it's an organic fuel and you react it with oxygen, you're going to get the same two products, material products, which is CO2 and water. All right? Now, energy is also a product, but it's not material. Energy comes out of this situation, which means combustion reactions are what? Well, in terms of energy, if energy comes out, what word comes to mind? Exergonic, exactly. This is exactly why we combust fuels, whether it's to drive the car down the road or whether we're combusting glucose as a fuel in cells. We're doing it for the purpose of releasing energy. It's not really that we want the products. It's we want the energy. The fuel is useful because it contains chemical energy in its bonds. And by rearranging those bonds, we can get some of that energy out. So this is a downhill, G-wise, exergonic reaction, combustion of a fuel. Well, if you put a match to methane, if you light it, you will all at once, in one step, get this output of CO2 and water and a bunch of energy. Cells do this with glucose in several steps, but you get the same two reactions as the final products. Or same two products as the final substances, CO2 and water, and energy comes out. Now let's look at the dots on the bottom. Each of these blue dots represents an electron. Not all of the electrons are shown here, only the ones that are involved in the bonds that get rearranged. But let's just talk for a second about hydrocarbons in general. What have I told you about hydrocarbons other than they, by definition, contain carbon and hydrogen only? What are the things that I've told you to remember about them? Yes, there is a lot of energy in the bonds. Whether it's a C-C bond, which, of course, methane doesn't have a C-C bond, but any hydrocarbon that has multiple C's would, right? Carbon-carbon bond in the carbon skeleton. Those have high energy, and so do CH bonds. But why do they have energy? Because of another thing that I've told you about about hydrocarbons in general, which is that they are nonpolar, right? Hydrocarbons in general are nonpolar, which is why gasoline as a mixture of hydrocarbons does not mix with water. But what is it that makes a nonpolar substance nonpolar? That's right. The two involved atoms have nearly identical or identical electronegativity values, which means they are equally greedy for the shared electrons, which means those electrons get more or less equally shared, which means that that pair of electrons, remember it's always a shared pair, that pair of electrons is not particularly close to either of the two atomic nuclei. Like this pair on the left here. It's not particularly close to the hydrogen or to the carbon because it's spending time around both of them. Why is that such a big deal? Well, think back to the slide I showed you when I first introduced energy levels. When we talked about shells and subshells, a shell is an energy level. And the lowest energy level is the one that's closest to the nucleus, right? They go up in energy as you get farther from the nucleus. These equally shared electron pairs are not able to be particularly close to either of these two atomic nuclei in the reactants. Same for oxygen, by the way. Oxygen is required for the reactant in order for it to be a combustion reaction. Oxygen is greedy as hell, but so is the other identical oxygen. So these four electrons being shared by the two oxygens aren't close to either oxygen either. Okay, when you have this reaction occur, the rearrangement of bonds is such that the electrons end up closer to one nucleus than they were before. In other words, they're going down in G value. They've gone to a lower energy level. You see that? This one's closer to the oxygen in CO2. These are closer to the oxygen in water than they were in either of these reactants before. So that's why there is energy that's coming out. These electrons are going to a lower energy level. Energy isn't created or destroyed, therefore it has to come out of the system, the thermodynamic system, which is the reaction itself. That's why it's exergonic. When you burn a fuel or combust a fuel. Okay, now, notice that the oxygen that's produced is actually receiving hydrogens from the fuel. I should say the water that's produced is produced because oxygen, as a reactant, is receiving hydrogens from the fuel. And that's true not just for this methane example, that's also true for fuels in cells, including glucose. So what we're going to get into the particulars of in these next several slides is that what cells do with their fuel, which starts out as glucose, that's the master fuel, is extract energy a little bit at a time in two different ways. There's two things that get done to the fuel. One is that, let me put it this way, if you want to get the maximum amount of usable energy out of fuel, which a cell wants to, in a sense, there's two things you need to do. You need to completely dismantle the carbon skeleton. So that means breaking all the C-C bonds, right? Glucose is a 6-carbon compound to start with. So completely dismantling it means that you're going to break it into 6 things that each have 1 carbon in it. That's part of the energy that you get out of it. But CH bonds, as you see here, are really valuable for their energy. So the other part of completely using fuel is to take all of the hydrogens off of the fuel, to pick off the hydrogens, just like they were picked off here. The only thing left of the fuel, which was methane to begin with, is CO2, no hydrogen left. Well, that's going to be exactly true for glucose as well in a cell. You start with a 6-carbon glucose fuel molecule with 12 hydrogens on it. You end up with 6 carbon dioxide molecules. That's complete dismantling of the skeleton. Each of which has no hydrogens left. They're all CO2 molecules. And therefore, they are completely spent fuel, worthless in terms of fuel. And in the process, we produce our own water. Now, this is different from the water that we take in that's already water, preformed water. We make water out of oxygen that we breathe and hydrogen from the food that we eat. Okay. That brings us then to 5. And this is a single chemical reaction as it's written. But to actually have this happen in one step, you would have to actually burn glucose, which you did. It wasn't pure glucose, but when you burned food in the lab, you were putting flame to organic fuels in the food. C6H12O6 actually could be any hexose, remember. There's many hexoses, but the most important hexose is the master fuel, glucose. So C6H12O6 is glucose. You react that with oxygen, that is a combustion of an organic fuel. The organic fuel is the glucose. And if you do that in one step by putting a flame to it, or heating it up enough, you produce 6 carbon dioxides. Like I said, completely dismantled carbon skeleton. None of the hydrogens are left. 6 waters, and a bunch of energy. And you can do, this is why marshmallows go up so quickly if you put a flame to them, because they're full of sugar. All right? Cells don't do it in one step, though. So this is not what's happening in the cell. This is a summary reaction that summarizes what's happening in the cell. All the intermediate steps are missing here, even though they really happen, importantly. This is what I meant before by a summary reaction. It doesn't matter in terms of delta G how many steps you take. The delta G only depends on the final and initial G values. So if you do this in a bunch of little steps rather than all one big step, it's the same value of delta G, the same output of energy. Okay? Well, the overall process that this chapter treats, which is the complete oxidation of glucose, is summarized by this one reaction, even though it happens in many, many reactions. Okay? Here we're looking at just the inputs and the outputs. And what I was saying before, and if it's not still not clear for slide one, is that if you wrote the summary reaction for the reciprocal process, which is photosynthesis, it would be exact reverse of this. Because these two material products would be the inputs into photosynthesis, and you'd produce glucose and oxygen. And, of course, you'd have to supply energy rather than getting it out. All right, now to six. How can you tell, other than me about to tell you, how can you tell just by looking at this that this is not a complete reaction? Right. This is only part of a molecule, right? It's not a complete molecule. These lines that have nothing at the ends mean that there really is something there. We're just focusing on one piece. And specifically, this is one part of glucose, the fuel. Think about when you built glucose with the balls and sticks. There were six carbons, but each carbon was associated with a hydrogen and a hydroxyl, right? Like you see here. So the same thing is happening six different times, basically, for a glucose. We're just looking at one of the carbons in the skeleton and the associated hydrogens for that carbon. Okay. I said that there's two things you need to do to get to completely use the fuel, but the way that we get energy out of our fuels is to oxidize the fuel. It's always the fuel that becomes oxidized. It doesn't get reduced. Remember in the methane example, it was oxygen that gets reduced. It's the fuel that gets oxidized. So we use our fuels, we spend our fuels by oxidizing them. And this is a redox reaction because hydrogens are being picked off of this fuel. We learned redox in terms of electrons by themselves, but really redox reactions can involve removal of an electron and a proton. And if you have an electron and a proton together, that is a hydrogen. All right? Okay, now the thing that we have not talked at all about so far is this NAD molecule. This is a molecule, that's an acronym. It's not a chemical symbol or formula. It's an acronym for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. So that's what the NAD stands for. We'll look at why it's called that in a second, or eventually, maybe next time we're meeting, because I'm almost out of time. But nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, NAD, is one very important coenzyme that we're going to discuss in this chapter. A coenzyme is a particle that carries something from one place, drops it off at another place. Now, in a city, what does that describe? Something that picks up something and drops it off. Yes. I figured you'd say Uber nowadays, or Lyft. A taxi, though, yes. A taxi has the specific job of picking things up and dropping them off, right? A passenger doesn't stay in the taxi forever. Well, NAD and another one called FAD that we'll look at later are coenzymes. They pick up passengers and drop them off. The passengers, I want you to think of in terms of subatomic particles. What's really being picked off of the fuel itself are hydrogens, two hydrogens at a time. But think of, instead of saying that you have two hydrogen atoms, tell me what you have in terms of subatomic particles. If you have two atoms, hydrogen atoms, what do you have as far as subatomic particles are concerned? Exactly. Two electrons and two protons. Just think of them as four distinct things at the moment that you're taking from the fuel. Now notice that NAD has two different forms. NAD plus on the left here. And it starts with a... In this form, it has a positive charge. All right? Now if you take one of those two electrons, you have two electrons and two protons. If you take one of those two and stick it on NAD plus, that's going to turn it into NAD. Now you still have another electron and you have two protons. If you take that second electron plus one of the protons, those together make up a hydrogen atom. So you stick those on as well. They get in the same taxi. Now it's NADH. But there's still one more proton. This fourth passenger can't fit in the taxi, basically. You can think of it that way. So that second proton, which is H+, remember, a hydrogen ion, a proton, H+, all mean the same thing. That's just, it's there, it's just not in the taxi. It's just part of the proton pool. But that's why the reduced version of this coenzyme is always listed as NADH plus H+. That's why it's plus H+. Okay? NAD plus is the oxidized form. And the last thing I'll say, because I'm out of time, is that coenzymes go back and forth between full taxi version and empty taxi version, just like real taxis. Well, the oxidized form always represents the empty taxi. That's lower energy, because these passengers have energy associated with them. The reduced form is always the full taxi, while it's carrying the passengers. And that has a lot more energy. All right.